Welcome to Still Scared, Talking Children's Horror. I'm Ren Wednesday, and with my co-host Adam Wybrow, I'll be talking about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. For our very first episode, Halloween episode, we're going to be talking about The Demon Headmaster by Gillian Cross. Enjoy! So some of the things we're going to talk about on this podcast will be ones that we experienced as children and some of them that we only came to as adults. But this was something that I definitely watched and read as a kid. How about you, Adam?
I don't remember reading it. I remember the original covers and the headmaster looking pretty ferocious, but I certainly remember the television programme. Just images like Hunky Parker, the grotesque pig television character. I remember the pig's face, and I remember there being great vines, like green vines.
Yeah, I think that's a later book. I remember there being... It's all sort of images of vines, and there's certainly parts from the first series that we're going to discuss that have definitely stuck with me.
I don't know if I have so many clear images from the first series, vaguely the octopus from Octopus Dare, but I certainly remember the ambience of it. And I remember it being a programme that I was scared to watch, but I also enjoyed watching, that I found compelling. And
yeah,
I definitely did watch of my own volition. And I remember it having an odd kind of melancholy. Like, obviously, it wasn't broadcast on Sunday evenings, but it had that Sunday evening melancholy to it as a child, that it's a very grey and concrete show. And I think that kind of dreariness...
It does have a touch of the Antiques Roadshow to it.
Yeah, I think the kind of languid pace of the first series and the kind of dreary eeriness of it all definitely stuck in my mind. So it's more... the memory of the ambience, I think, that stayed with me than, like, the plot, for instance.
Yeah. So, for people who haven't seen it or read it, the premise of the first book is that the headmaster of the school can control nearly everyone, pupils and teachers included, through hypnotism. And he uses this to create his vision of a perfectly orderly, sterile, obedient school. There's a few pupils who can resist the hypnotism, including the main character Dinah's foster brothers. At the beginning of the story, Dinah has just joined the school, so we learn about what's going on as she does. So, sort of, I guess as this is about children's horror, I suppose maybe talking about what is scary about it might be a good place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I think... part of what makes it scary is, while it's called The Demon Headmaster, it's not, certainly not in the first book, very fantastical. And though the headmaster seems to have demonic aspects, it's never clearly established, you know, whether he's an alien or human or a demon, you know, quite what he is. But his actual power of hypnosis is one clearly rooted in reality. And in fact, a lot of the means at his disposal as headmaster in the first book and first three episodes of the TV series are ones that an actual cruel or abusive headmaster would have. That the children get told off. And of course, when they go home to tell Dinah's mum what's been going on, she says to the two brothers, to Harvey and Lloyd, you know, you're lying, you're making this up, you just got in trouble for bad behaviour, that's what the school told me. And, you know, this is entirely plausible. And I think it speaks to that terrible power disparity which you feel quite keenly as a child between yourself and, if not so much necessarily individual teachers, just the school as an institution, and between children and adults, and that fear that things might happen to you or might be done to you, and you might not be believed.
Yeah, definitely. And it's that, it's kind of that fear's heightened with the hypnosis, which means that they definitely won't be believed because all the other children have been hypnotized to repeat these rote phrases talking about how marvelous the headmaster is.
Yeah, of course. So they don't even have the kind of, they do have solidarity, but they have this sort of tiny solidarity group called Splat that Lloyd and Harvey are members of, and Lloyd, I think, the leader of at the start of the first book, and Dinah, when they sort of learn to trust her, is initiated and brought into the fold.
Mm.
So they have space of respite, but, you know, otherwise they're on their own. And the demon headmaster partly controls the school through this regime of prefects, which, again, it's something based in real life, the idea of prefects being stand-ins for teachers' authority or the rules of the school is obviously a real one. The prefects are very good at kind of divide and rule. So even these tight friendships, and I think they are very tight, definitely in the first two books, are sometimes threatened. Like in the second book, The Prime Minister's Brain, where the demon headmaster tries to get access to the Prime Minister through this kind of convoluted scheme involving a hypnotic video game called Octopus Stare. And this, you know, you get the sense that there are tensions in the group, that two of the younger kids really don't like this game at all and don't really get the appeal of playing video games and want to be playing outside, whereas their older friends and siblings, you know, just want to be playing video games or like Dinah learning to program.
Oh, yeah. We'll come back to The Prime Minister's Brain, I think, but I did want to ask you, you say, because in my copy, I think I have a revised, like an updated version where Dinah's making a website for the group.
That's interesting. So in my copy of The Prime Minister's Brain, she's learning to program in BASIC.
And that is more appropriate for 1985.
And in fact, wonderfully, you get her BASIC coding.
Oh, wow.
So I'll just read you, I mean, we'll go back to the first book, but if I could just read you the start of my copy of The Prime Minister's Brain. It starts, Dinah. Settling herself into the crook of the big old pear tree, Dinah began to check the computer program she was writing. 2100, print is sun shining, Y or N? Colon, quotes, semicolon. 2110, input, A, dollar sign. Line break. 2120, if A dollar sign equals Y, then go to 2300.
That's really cool.
there are several passages of this interspersed through the first two or three chapters.
Okay, it's fairly revised then, because my copy is just says, Dinah's building a Splat website.
I think that's a shame, because you really do get the sense in that original copy of Dinah as a budding programmer.
Yeah.
Which is really cool, right?
Yeah.
and that her programming smarts are partly what let her infiltrate the
government sense. Security sector.
I like the idea that Dinah, I mean, it might be good to talk about Dinah as hero briefly, because I think she's an interesting hero or protagonist for a children's series, but that she starts off certainly not very communicative.
Yes, particularly in the books, she's a little more forthcoming in the TV series, but in the first book she's, well, Lloyd describes her as a robot when he first meets her, and she's very, very restrained.
What's interesting is it's almost as though parallels are sometimes being made between the Demon Headmaster and Dinah, I think. Like in the kind of emotional blunting and roboticness. But of course we have access to Dinah's inner thoughts and emotional life, and so we know that this is just an outward appearance, that actually she's a very self-reflective and actually emotionally self-aware person. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't always choose to express this, that she's very reticent and careful before displaying her emotions. But I find it quite interesting that in one of the later Demon Headmaster books, the Demon Headmaster seeks to manufacture a kind of alien robotic, who is a clone, basically, of Dinah, who is evil, and so has all of Dinah's intelligence, but none of her kind of compassion and emotional self-insight.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of dark, you know, dark or Metal Mario, you know, it's the sort of dark version, I guess, or shadow version, is a better way of putting it, of Dinah.
Yeah. For a bit of context, Dinah's incredibly intelligent, but tries to hide it at first. And even from the first book, the Demon Headmaster is trying to find ways to use her. When he works out that she's very intelligent, at the end of the book, she has to facilitate his plan to hypnotize the country through the TV by winning this school quiz.
Which occurs on the Eddie Hare show, which I think is one thing that's rendered actually more vividly for me in the book than it was on the television program. That in the book, you really have a sense of this program of absolute, slightly unsettling chaos it sounds like, you know, a show with genuine health and safety violations, which to be fair, of course, is true of kids' TV of the late 80s and early 90s. You had shows like, you know, Fun House and things with kids sort of slipping on Gunge, which was this incredibly kind of 90s fixation, I think. Right? Or slime.
Yeah.
Like, sort of fluorescent coloured sort of multicoloured goop. Poured on people.
I feel like the rendition of the Eddie Hare show in the TV series definitely reminded me of Get Your Own Back.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which was a 90s kids' TV show where children competed to pour gunge over parents or teachers or other authority figures.
Yeah, generally for perceived slights, which would often vary in fairness or magnitude, which is a very odd thing because there's this sort of flattening of moral difference in the show. Like, you know, one of them might be that the kid, I don't know, really doesn't like eating lettuce, and their dad forced them to eat lettuce. You think, oh, okay, that's a bit mean. Fair enough. But then another one might be the kid wants to go to space, and his mum says, well, no, you can't go to space. You know, and these are treated as sort of equally punishment-worthy offences.
Yeah, but we're definitely on a tangent now. But yeah, in the book, they describe... It describes Eddie Hare wrestling the spaghetti, and the spaghetti wrestling back and sneezing, which, when I read that, I just had to pause for a moment and try and imagine spaghetti sneezing. It seems... Yeah, it does seem somewhat magical.
It does, and Eddie Hare himself seems to stay, even outside his show, within this sort of role, if it is a role, as this kind of madcap prankster figure. So he's described as driving through the streets in his car, and the car being, you know, multicoloured and having polka dots, and that when one of the kids sort of stops him, in fact, to try to prevent the broadcast and recording of the Eddie Hare show, because they know at this point it's part of the Prime Minister's plans, and they try to stall Eddie Hare by asking for an autograph, and Eddie Hare kind of gleefully proclaims that he can't write, and then sort of laughs and speeds off.
Yeah, he does seem a lot more like a kind of embodiment of chaos in opposition to the Demon Headmaster being the embodiment of order and sterility and
stuff. Absolutely.
If we just backtrack a little bit. So I wanted to talk about the snowball scene, which is one that really stuck in my memory from having seen it as a kid. And it's going back to the theme of not being believed as a child. I think this is the scene where that really hits home. Because Dinah feels like knows that something is wrong, but she doesn't know exactly what it is. So she decides that she'll break a rule to see what will happen. And she throws a snowball in the playground. But unfortunately, her foster brother Harvey wants to join in. And despite Lloyd trying to stop him, all three of them get punished. The prefects, who we'll come back to some more, decide that their punishment should be for them to take off their coats, scarves and gloves and sweep all the snow into the centre of the playground and then make all of that snow into snowballs. And yeah, the way it's very vividly written, you can imagine how painful it is having to touch all this wet, cold snow and form it into snowballs with your hands.
And Harvey is described as having asthma as well.
Yeah.
So he's clearly, you know, in serious, potentially danger doing this.
Yeah, in the TV series, I think Dinah says Harvey might die or something. And Rose, who's the prefect who's engineered this punishment, just does this, like, horrendous, like, evil little smile at that. It was just like this touch, like, just like she was delighted at the idea that he might die.
Yeah, we should talk about the child actors in particular more. I mean, generally, I'd say the child performances are variable. Although the fact that some of the child performances are more stilted is okay, because it's oddly in keeping with the atmosphere and thematics of the show, because of course the kids are meant to be hypnotised a lot of the time.
Yes.
So, you know, that some of the kids sound like they're just parroting back lines really doesn't matter, and actually
that's true, actually, yeah.
If anything, to the strength of the show. But some of the child actors are very good, and I think Catherine Wyeth is particularly good, I think, as Rose. Mm. And as you've kind of said, she has this genuine malevolence, which is quite unsettling, that I don't know if she'd experienced bullying herself and she's kind of channeling that back, or you know, where that's coming from. But she does a very good job at kind of subtly communicating the fact that some of the prefects are just sort of robotic, like sentinels. Whereas you get the sense that the character of Rose is genuinely a pretty nasty piece of work.
Yeah, no, she's incredible. She was one of my strongest memories of the TV series. And I was genuinely surprised to watch it again and see that she is about 14 years old. you know, she's a child, but she has such a villainous presence. And I think she becomes the secondary villain in the first three episodes.
Oh, yeah, and she becomes... I mean, she's kept in as a character. I remember they do things with her in later seasons.
Yeah. Do they?
Yeah, yeah. So I imagined... Yeah, she certainly... She isn't in the last three episodes, but she certainly reappears.
Oh, good.
Yeah, if you look at the IMDb page, she's credited for 10 episodes in total. So there's certainly a lot more of her. I mean, to put that in context, the actor playing the Demon Headmaster, Terence Hardman, is credited for 19 episodes.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, no, I think she's sort of threatening to upstage Terence Hardman at points in this first three episodes. She's just so good.
Yeah, I mean Hardman certainly is a chilling presence. But you do get the sense of him as implacable, that, you know, he's entirely unmoved by pleas for mercy, right? Which I think is what makes him scary, is that the character of the Demon Headmaster seems to not have a compassionate bone in his body.
Yeah, and he's watching in the snowball scene when at one point Dinah says, this is too much. The headmaster won't stand for this. Surely this punishment is too barbaric. And then she looks up and sees the demon headmaster watching from the staff room.
Yeah, no, it's a nice kind of pullback and reveal moment, really, that she still has faith at this point that, you know, the corruption doesn't run that high.
Yeah.
Right? And that, oh yes, of course it does.
Yeah.
it's interesting that is that same kind of journey from trusting implicitly the system to incredulity to then the horrific realization that no, they're in on it, is given to Robert, who's a minor character in the second book, The Prime Minister's Brain.
Oh, yeah.
So he tries to report the machinations to the Demon Headmaster, is now in the guise of the computer director, who's conducting a quiz of sorts or a test to find the best computer brain of the year or something. But basically, he's trying to root out kind of kids who are clever with computers so they can hack into this system for him. But the character of Robert, who's one of the brains, so-called, who's along for the competition, tries to explain to the computer director or the demon headmaster what's going on and says, look, we're being treated, this isn't acceptable. And of course, again, the demon headmaster or computer director, is completely nonplussed. You know, in fact, he has him taken away for being outspoken.
Yeah. Yes, it's... he doesn't have a name apart from the various titles that he assumes. I don't know if he gets a name later. Probably not.
It's funny because that's why I was sort of struggling a second there to think, do you still call him the Demon Headmaster? Well, the Demon Headmaster is his role, but you can't really just call him the demon. I don't know if it's like Stephen King's It, and that, you know, there's some kind of primal, I don't know, arachnid-like in it. You know, there's some sort of evil elder god behind it all.
My goodness.
Yog-Shogoth or something. He's actually just puppeteering these vessels. But,
I mean, that makes it even scarier, so... Yeah.
Too rich for my blood.
Oh, that's a bit far, Adam.
I think the other kids are really good as well. I mean, the lead trio, I'd say, of Dinah, Lloyd and Harvey. So Frances, Amy, Gunnar Cawthery, and Thomas, I think it's Sicarius, it might be pronounced. They're all really good, I think. Amy as Dinah doesn't quite have communicate the kind of alienation, perhaps, that Dinah's definitely experiencing in the first book. You know, she's definitely a much warmer presence than the Dinah in the book. I think she seems quite vulnerable, basically. I think both in the book and in the programme, in different ways, Dinah is a very likeable character.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Which is interesting and good, because she's not necessarily likeable in the conventional ways you might expect from a children's book. She's not massively gregarious. She's not especially funny. She's fairly kind of serious as child protagonists go. She isn't one for epic adventures. Clearly, in the Prime Minister's Brain, she'd rather be programming. But I think she's shown to have a kind of integrity, sort of belief in goodness and the truth, which stands firm. And which means it's all the more devastating for her and us as readers when she's hypnotised into saying things which she knows to be lies, because that clearly is a violation of her character, and she's very confused as to why she finds that she's parroting lies which she knows she doesn't believe. And, you know, she's not a liar, so she's sort of troubled by this, because she realises, I think, quite quickly that something's wrong and something is being done against her will.
Yeah. This might be a good time to talk a bit more about the Prime Minister's Brain, because there's this sort of escalation that happens between the first and second books, where as you say, in the first book, she's sort of parroting these lines that the headmaster has hypnotized her to say, and she doesn't know why she's saying them. But in the second book, where it's this images of these octopuses that are hypnotizing people, it has an emotional effect on her, in that when she looks at this octopus, she feels, when she gets the letter that says that she's won the competition, but she needs to get this very expensive computer to come to the final, looking at this octopus makes her feel angry and overwhelmed with emotion at the idea that she wouldn't be able to do it. And it's very out of character. And I don't think we really see any more of this in the book, but it is an interesting ramping up of the hypnotism that this time it has an emotional effect.
Yeah, and it's also compared explicitly late in the book to a drug or alcohol addiction.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that Dinah and the other kids were affected by it. And I find it quite interesting that the two kids who aren't affected by it, which is Harvey and...
Ingrid.
Is it Ingrid? Yeah. I was trying to think if it was Mandy or Ingrid. Yeah, Ingrid. That they're the two youngest kids in the group.
Mm-hmm.
And they aren't particularly affected by it. But the other kids kind of crave this octopus. Digital octopus on the screens, and in the book, every time it comes up, you have the word octopus in bold, and then sis, octopus, which I rather like.
And it does it on the in the TV series. It goes octopus, just sort of hisses it in the background.
But one thing I liked about that if we think of the show, and I don't want to sort of overread it, you know, but if it is functioning as an allegory of sorts for a repressive or autocratic political regime, then while the first series is more of a fascist state being depicted, so it's focusing on the institutionalization of order through orderlies, basically, you know, through a sort of sequence of command and a sort of stratification of power, that you have this guy at the top who's making his underlings do things, who, you know, then are willing to use torture and fear to keep the kids in their place. Whereas it strikes me that the second one moves more towards a kind of Stalinist kind of depiction, or depiction of autocratic government you got in communist regimes. And I say this because a lot of my academic writing is on communist era Czechoslovakia. And one thing that I've noticed reading testimony through people who lived through that time is the idea of internalized censorship.
Mm-hmm.
So just the threat that you were being watched all the time and that your neighbours might inform on you was enough to make artists censor their own work, to the degree that, yes, there were formal censorship bodies in the way there were under Nazism, but certainly not in the same way and not to the degree. It's more that because you didn't quite know if you'd get in trouble for doing something transgressive, you know, making a transgressive piece of art, you'd be more likely to err on the side of caution. And because you didn't know which of your family members or friends might be an informer, and, you know, there are a lot of party members, that you sort of internalise these things. So at a certain point, physical violence, even though the threat of physical violence certainly might still be present, isn't even necessary because the fear is internalised and sort of does the work for the state, basically. I think you kind of get that to a degree in the second book. This idea that the demon headmaster or becoming the computer director doesn't always have to do that much.
Yeah.
You know, once he's set up the system, he can kind of sit back and let the system do its work for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he set up a very elaborate, is it the office building where the final takes place, where his where the children are going to break into the Prime Minister's computer for him? Is yes, a very elaborately constructed, automated system.
Yeah, governed by a supercomputer, basically.
Yeah.
So it is staffed to a degree. There are sort of people in white lab coats who do some work, seemingly, or work as guards. But apart from that...
But none of them make really any impression at all, unlike the prefects.
Yes, yeah, that's a good point. They're very anonymous and autonomous, right? where what does make an impression instead are the little robots, right? Mm-hmm. So in the warehouse where all the food's kept are these little robots with extendable arms that put things on the shelves. And similarly, there's a kind of robot assembly line producing the meals for the children in the second book.
And this was written in 1985, so this was somewhat more fantastical than it is now.
that's a good point, that it's got this kind of techno-futurist thing going on almost, mm-hmm. that now seems kind of more banal than it would have done at the time.
I wanted to mention a little bit about the context of the time, just because 1985... when this is written.
So it's written sort of quite a bit before the television series. So the television series ran from 1996 to 1998.
Mm-hmm. So you've got sort of both, in the TV series, you have sort of both the context of both times kind of going on. And I feel like maybe the 80s influence is kind of the idea of these sort of whiz kid kids who are hacking into a government computer, kind of a lot of fears then of what young people might do with this new technology that they don't really understand, and they could break into military secrets or whatever.
Yeah, that's certainly a very 80s concern, although I'm just looking up when the first Hackers film came out. Okay, so Hackers is 1995.
What about War Games?
War Games is a bit earlier than that. That's a good point. Yeah, I was thinking more of that kind of cyber dystopia kind of aesthetic going on in the 90s, right? I think of something like Hackers or Lawnmower Man, right?
I have no idea what that is.
or Existines, for instance, the film. And obviously the Demon Head Master never quite reaches, you know, that level of technological horror or body horror. But certainly this dystopian vision of an automated and computerized system and a society of greater abstraction.
Yeah.
It is definitely present in the second book and goes forward as the series progresses. I mean, let's say you get sort of genetic engineering coming in as a topic in one of the later seasons. So, you know, I mean, they're not quite after school specials, but yeah, they are definitely engaging with issues at the time.
Yeah, and there's also the, I think, quite 90s fear of children becoming addicted to computer games that might be coming in there a bit.
And the idea of the online realm as this kind of other and uncanny other space, right? Of sort of limitless imagination but potentially limitless horror. like you know, when you watch sort of adverts for that time for home computers and the internet, there's this real sense of sort of awe but also abstraction, that kind of 90s trope that you're seeing a resurgence now of. I've used some VR technology recently, and I found it really interesting that within the VR world, to demarcate where in the real world a wall was you can't get past is a is a green glowing grid.
Oh, and really?
Which is such a kind of 90s image of the digital world.
Yeah.
So I found that quite interesting. I mean, you know, around the time I would have been watching The Demon Headmaster, I would have also been going on trips with my my now I can see incredibly patient father. I don't think I appreciated this quite enough at the time, to Sega World in London Trocadero, yeah, which became Funland, which mm-hmm. was at the time the largest arcade in Europe. And obviously it had all sorts of arcade games, but also had sort of early and proto VR technology and immersive indoor rides, like, you know, rides where you could wear a headset and simulators and things like that.
It makes me think of, do you know that series one episode of Buffy where there's a demon on the computer?
Yes, I do vaguely remember that one, yeah.
Yeah. And that Goosebumps book.
What, is that like, something like, it's not It Came From The Web, but it's...
No, I think it is It Came From The Internet.
And it is literally, right, a kind of digital, a CGI spider that comes out of the computer, I think.
Yes, out of the World Wide Web.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And from thence the hilarity ensues.
Yeah,
or the indeed. Horror. We're sure to talk about Goosebumps. I'd say probably on several episodes, because it would be impossible.
Because it's, yes, there's a lot of Goosebumps to talk about.
I mean, certainly if you look up children's horror on Goodreads, mm-hmm. it is just R.L. Stein after R.L. Stein, like, so much. Yeah. I mean, what do you think that the Demon Headmaster and the Prime Minister's Brain have that the Goosebumps books don't have, for instance? You know, what do you think makes them special in terms of being children's books and also children's horror?
I mean, I think probably generally more of a deeper look at issues than the Goosebumps books generally go in for. I think as you were saying at the start, the atmosphere of both the books and the TV series is this very chilly, downbeat sort of feeling to it that is not quite as campy as Goosebumps books.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite call it campy, that's true. There might be kitschy elements, but it's not flamboyant. Mm. I mean, it's not an extravagant show, really. There is something quite down-to-earth about it. I'm not saying it's continuing in the British tradition of kitchen sink realism, but it has that kind of dreary workadayness to it, which I think is what made it disturbing as a child, that it feels that it does take place within a believable world that is our own or like our own, rather than a kind of more fantastical realm.
Yeah, I think so. I think there is something quite British about that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you look at sort of 70s horror, right, you have this sort of interest in parochial horror, almost, or kind of folk horror. So it struck me, I mean, this is often talked about under the rubric of hauntology.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never managed to find a coherent definition of what on earth hauntology is. It seems to be something like I don't know, the unveiling of what should be veiled by nostalgia, or giving the veils of nostalgia a kind of ontological presence, taking what was kind of subtextual and under the surface in these 1970s horror films and programmes, and bringing them to the surface and taking what was on the surface and putting that under, that you, like, if you think about something like Look Around You, I think Look Around You has this thing where the most kind of staid aspects of 1970s educational videos kind of become the creepiest.
Yeah.
It's the dreary synth music and the, you know, commands to have your textbooks ready that become troubling and unsettling. Whereas all the kind of fantastical, kind of magical stuff is done in a very matter-of-fact way.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I don't think the Demon Headmaster is necessarily part of any kind of bigger tradition, but I definitely get what you mean when you say that it is so specifically British, and it does strike me as kind of doing almost for the urban environment what those 70s kids horror programmes like The Owl Service or The Changes did for the rural or the countryside. That, you know, in those stories, it's very much about these sort of hidden energies and currents under old England, drawing on ideas from the folk revival of ley lines and Wicca and, you know, ancient kind of stuff you get in The Wicker Man as well. Whereas I think, like, the rhythms in The Demon Headmaster are far more urban, basically, and far more kind of regimented, that it's a kind of Britain sapped of vitality, you know, it's this portrait of a kind of brutalist concrete Britain.
Yeah, and there's the scene where they're trying to find the building where the final takes place, and it says that it's an island, and they're stuck on the tube, and it's stuffy and horrible, and they're like, oh, won't it be lovely to go to this island, to the running water and the clear air, and they get there, and it's a traffic island. So yeah, there's no respite, really.
No, that's an interesting point. There is very little respite in both. But, you know, the respite comes right at the end of the first book and right at the beginning of the second book.
And it's maybe slightly lampshaded, but the rest of Splat spend a lot of time climbing up a rubbish chute. A lot of time. Right, like, at one point, one of them complains about how they've done nothing but climb up a rubbish chute.
Which seems like a bit of a meta joke.
But
I'd say about a quarter of the Prime Minister's brain. I think it's fair to say, certainly concerning those characters, is them climbing up the rubbish chute. but it's interesting because the concern with waste seems to have changed. It's handled differently in the Prime Minister's brain. So you're talking about Eddie Hare in The Demon Headmaster, and you know, the sort of horror, the description of the gunge and the spaghetti monster and the kind of chaotic mess of this TV show, and the kids loving this and reveling in it, while, you know, it's deeply offensive to the kind of staid and orderly Demon Headmaster. But obviously, in the Prime Minister's brain, the kids aren't, you know, gleefully jumping for joy at having to climb up a rubbish chute. And, you know, there are quite sort of long descriptions of carrot peelings and other stuff, you know. And it's quite grubby, right? It sounds sort of sticky and unpleasant, that it is. It's quite vivid. I don't know if it's just being set up in contrast to the sterility of the computer lab. There's something about, you know, how the Prime Minister's plans don't factor in waste, or that it's always about repressing that which is messy, that which isn't orderly.
But also, Adam, also, it's the rubbish chute that saves them.
This is true. So at the end of the Prime Minister's brain, the Prime Minister rigs the computer system. So he's got the kids to hack into the system for him. And he takes a helicopter, which is a bit foregrounded. There's quite a lot of talk about this helicopter early on in the book. So we know it's going to come up again. And the roof of the building opens, and he takes this helicopter to fly to Downing Street. And to stop the kids from foiling his plans, he rigs up the computer system so that any interference with it will set off an explosive device, basically, and it will set the building aflame. And this is hidden within the elevator. So they do try to prevent his plan and eventually succeed. And so the elevator catches light. And so, as you're saying, so they have to escape, and the only way they can escape is down through the rubbish chute.
And it is a pretty dark scene in which the children vote to stop the Demon Headmaster, computer director, even if it means burning to death in an office building.
Yeah, and it's very clear that that's what the stakes are.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they basically outright state, right, if we do this, we're probably going to die. So, are we doing this?
Yeah. Which is probably a good point to... I wanted to just talk about the headmaster's complete lack of qualms about physically harming children.
Please do.
From the first book, it's a theme, because in order to test that Dinah is actually hypnotized, he sticks a pin in her arm, and one time she's just pretending to be hypnotized, and he pricks her with this pin to check. And
I've highlighted that line actually in my copy. It's a really chilling last line. If you don't mind, I'll just read this last passage. So she's going under hypnosis, and it says, "But the words in her head drifted off into silence and floated away on a great tide of sleep as she slumped slowly forward in her chair." And then, "This time she did not feel a thing when the headmaster stuck the pin into her arm." It's a genuinely quite a chilling sentence, I think. Just the kind of matter-of-factness about it.
And I think also in the TV series, the headmaster quite threateningly opens a letter with sort of his old-fashioned letter openers that are basically a dagger, which... like, it's a little bit of foreshadowing.
And of course, in the third episode, the kids are confronted trying to halt the recording and broadcast of the Eddie Hare show. Yes. And do you want to say what headmaster does?
So the headmaster finds them at this critical moment, and he brings with him the prefects and a group of hypnotised children. When Splat tries to stand up to him and say, "No, we're not going to let you do this," he tells the children, I quote, "In front of you are six straw dolls that are no longer needed. You will advance on them and pull them to pieces." And Terence Hardiman really relishes that line. And the children advance on the members of Splat and start pulling at their clothes and tugging their hair, and they will pull them to pieces.
That's one thing the books and then the programme do very well, is the sense of threat does feel very real. you don't get the sense that the demon headmaster is kidding around. As he said, definitely doesn't have any compunctions when it comes to murdering children.
Yeah. And I thought this was actually a very good use of the 90s CGI in this scene.
Right. You have to remind me, because it's a little... I watched the series a couple of months back now. So.
Oh, okay. So when he tells the children, "In front of you are six straw dolls," you see from the children's perspective like an animation sort of overlay of those straw... like those corn dollies, like...
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like
straw dolls, yeah. Just overlaid over the members of Splat. and it's very simple, but it really works.
Well, I think that could be said of the series and the books of the whole, that they're not doing anything, you know, massively fancy. You know, the narratives are simple. But they do work. You know, I was quite surprised rewatching the programme at how well it holds together, and that, you know, I found it perfectly watchable as an adult. I certainly didn't feel I had to watch it ironically or just nostalgically. You know, I did find it genuinely... Yeah, it's patchy, but I found it genuinely unsettling and quite engaging, and I did think some of the acting, say especially... by Catherine Wyeth playing Rose, you know, really good.
Yeah.
I just wanted to finish off with one last thing, which is that Gillian Cross is sometimes using the Demon Headmaster books as a way of making comments about the educational system. And
mm-hmm.
she's sneaking in, you know, her opinions about the educational system. Certainly, the demon headmaster's hypnosis in the first book is meant to resemble learning by rote, I think.
Right, because this was... Yeah, this was written under a Tory government, as we are now again, and certainly Michael Gove, as Education Secretary, had very old-fashioned ideas about learning, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, this is before, I mean, well, there are probably things to take issue with what the how the Blair government changed education. It did also mark some really progressive shifts in terms of how kids learn, and say, taking a subject like history and making it far more about how you analyse evidence and how you interpret mm-hmm. historical sources. Whereas I think before that, or certainly still under Thatcher, you had a system which was still based more in rote learning, that, you know, learning about history was more learning the facts, being able to reel off a list of the kings of England. Mm-hmm. And you see that, obviously, this is how the kids are learning, that when they're in the playground, instead of playing, they just stand together in small rings and chant off lists of facts.
Yeah. And it's definitely seen as regressive and old-fashioned. And in the book, Dinah says, the head teacher, and one of them corrects him and says, oh, you have to say headmaster.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is definitely a throwback to previous times. I mean, I think that was old-fashioned by the 80s, presumably.
Yeah. No, I found quite a direct indictment of the demon headmaster's teaching methods. That Ingrid and Dinah are talking about the Eddie Hare show, and Ingrid says, I love it, especially the great school quiz. The question's so hard, I can never do any of them. Dinah replies, that's because we're all taught parrot fashion. The questions in the quiz are puzzles, and no one in our school's encouraged to think. It's quite the wrong mm-hmm. quiz for our sort of school.
Yeah.
And it looks like from... So there was an interview I read in, I think, The New Statesman?
Oh, yeah.
With Gillian Cross about the new Demon Headmaster book. And she was saying how, you know, it's been 15 years since she wrote one, and going back to the Demon Headmaster and writing a new book, the school system has changed a lot in that time. So, you know, I suspect from what she was saying that the new one, you know, takes aim at Ofsted, for one thing, and the academisation of schools.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, teaching, you know, kids as kind of matrix...
As a business.
Yeah, exactly. Teaching as a business, as little consumers. And thinking too much in terms of quantifiable outcomes and what you can mm-hmm. plot on a graph, rather than any kind of deeper, more nourishing education.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'd be interested to read it to see how she depicts this new school, and yeah, if her opinions have kind of changed, and what the demon headmaster will be like now, you know, what means of control, whether he'll still use hypnosis.
Or will he have a different power for a different time?
Yeah, I don't know what that flash animations, who knows. I think that would have been very early 2000s, so heaven knows what it'd be now. it's been a while since I was in school.
I'm just, while we're talking about politics, did you think that he resembled John Major? Is that a reach?
I think if you went as John Major to a Halloween party,
yes,
people might mistake you for the Demon Head.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah. okay, on that yeah, suitably ghoulish image. We'll end things here. So do you want to do the credits today, since you're probably going to do a better job of it than me?
So our theme music is by Maki Yamazaki, and you can find their work at makiyamazaki.com. Their outro is by Joe Kelly, and you can find his band Etao Shin, which is Etao Shin, at etaoshin.co.uk. And I want to just give an extra thank you to Matt Dillon, who is the War Llama on Twitter, because it was thanks to his podcasting panels at Nine Worlds that I felt like I could actually do this at all. So thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
So you can find me on Twitter at Ren Wednesday. And Adam?
You can find me on Twitter at AlGoreRhythm, with underscores. the pun being algorithms.
Yes.
And should we just say thank you for the art as well?
By Letty Wilson. And I will put a link to her website in the show notes. So yeah.
And of course, The Demon Headmaster by Julian Cross.
Okay.
Thanks.
Adam, we should probably come up with a sign-off. I forgot about this.
Oh, keep it spooky.
Yeah, until next time, keep it spooky.
Bye,
maybe we'll come up
kids.
With a better one. Bye, creepy kids. Okay.